Hey, and welcome to the RUP podcast. I'm James Roycroft Davis, and I founded this podcast after I recently found myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started talking about how I felt. This podcast features mostly men's stories about getting into a rut and what it was like being there, but most importantly, how they got out of it. In this episode of The Rut, I sit down with professional rugby players Jack Willis and James Gaskell. Jack and James both play for Wasps, and have recently both had serious injuries which led to their mental health suffering. Jack broke into the Wasps first team in 2017, tearing up trees in the Premiership, leading to him being selected on England's summer tour of South Africa in 2018. However, a week after being selected for England, Jack suffered a serious knee injury against Saracens in the Premiership semi-finals. Jack recounts the toll it took on his mental health in the week after having surgery and struggling to come to terms with being completely immobile. However, after a message from Henry Fraser, Jack talks about the process of coming to terms with his injury and moving forward with his recovery. James has played almost 200 Premiership games for both Sale and Wasps, but recently has had a series of injuries, including a problem with his back, which had several complications. They led him to struggle with his mental health, considering whether all of this was worth it. Here is Jack and James' stories, so please, as always, leave all judgment at the door.
Gents, how are we?
Mate, very well yourself?
Yeah, fine.
Thank you.
Good. Yeah, just trying to enjoy lockdown. It's not going as well as I thought it was going to go. but yeah. The life of a rugby player has changed significantly, though, I can imagine.
Yes, it's a strange one. That's a certain. With used to a bit of a structure on a day-to-day basis. You're going in, you're told what to eat, what to wear, where to be in certain places. And then as soon as you're stuck at home, you've got to sort of build your own structure. You can, if you end up lying in till God knows what time, then you end up wasting a lot of the day. So trying to get that, keep a bit of structure to your life so that you're nice and productive.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, trying to motivate yourself to go and run a Bronco on a Monday morning when you've not got anybody watching you and the conditioner is telling you you've got to send a time in and you roughly know what sort of time you can hit, and it's very easy to make that time up. But yeah, as I say, it's.
I mean, that's not perfect. Have they not asked you to record that either? So you're not doing a video. You could literally just send a time in, and that'd be it. Get back to playing Call of Duty.
Pretty much send a time and hope that nobody questions you.
Yeah, that's, you were talking about Reader earlier, and he is exactly the prime suspect for that. Back in the day when we were in rehab, we used to. We used to have swimming sessions. He'd be like, "Oh, Jack, you just, if anyone asks, just say that I came down with you to the pool." Yeah, no worries.
Excellent. Look, guys, thanks so much for. Oh, sorry, I lost you there, Jack.
That's right. He even asked me once to take a picture of the menu at the Warwickshire to and send it to him so that he could send it to the coach to prove that he'd been to the pool.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Excellent. I mean, there's probably endless stories about Alex. But yeah, he was excellent on the pod, so I won't be saying anything. look, both of you, thanks for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. Obviously, we've spoken before about each of your stories. So this is kind of an opportunity for you guys and obviously for the people listening to kind of understand what you guys have been through in professional rugby with injuries, etc., and have a chat and kind of be all on the same relatable level where you're playing amateur sport to professional sport and having a listen to talk about trials, tribulations of injuries and mental struggles around selection, etc. But first and foremost, from you guys, like, why did you want to come on the pod apart from me begging you to come on?
I guess from my perspective is the whole trying to get people to open up and talk has been a big thing across the media and within social groups over the last two or three years, especially. And, you know, I think it's very important that people do realise that, you know, even rugby players are normal people. Mm. We are just a normal Joe Bloggs person that, you know, I think in a world where we're seen as these tough macho men that go around hitting each other and the likes on a Saturday afternoon, that, you know, we don't have the same sort of thoughts as the random person walking down the street. And as I say, after having the conversation with you, from a personal point of view, I thought it was very important to sort of get that message across and sort of delve into some of the stuff that I've experienced and whatnot.
Yeah, I think I'd second that as well. What James has said, it's just important that the message of talking to people and an opening up is a key one. But I think for me, a motivation of hopefully this is, there'll be an element of this podcast and the stuff that we talk about that just educates people on some of the cues that people have. Because I think the tough thing is, I think we've all been guilty of it in the past. You could chat to someone, ask them how they are, and they're like, oh, I'm doing okay. And it just, nothing pops up in a normal conversation, but it's kind of working out the sort of social cues of if someone's not quite themselves and picking up on that.
Interesting. Yeah, the word fine is an interesting one for me. That's normally, if somebody says they're fine, that's normally an indicator they're not fine.
Especially if it's your missus and you say,
fine, yeah. It's just not true, is it? Yeah, exactly. Guys, I wanted to go into a bit of your stories and obviously the run-up to being in a rut. So, James, why don't we start with you? Tell us a bit about your story and moving into obviously the injuries and tackling that.
I guess I've been very lucky and sort of privileged to be able to play the sport I love for 12 years. And I suppose injuries have always been part and parcel of the job. And throughout, especially the first 8 or 9 years, I had a couple of serious ones that were probably 3 or 4 years apart. And you can sort of take that because, as you say, you go around hitting blokes on a Saturday afternoon and there's some big blokes out there that can cause some serious damage. And so I sort of, from that perspective, I thought I'd been fairly lucky, but probably over the last 2 to 3 years, the injuries have become a lot more frequent. And, you know, I've spent a fair bit of time on the sideline. And I guess the one that's really sort of niggled me is I had a problem with my back that caused essentially the neural side of my right leg to not receive messages, which in essence led it to tear. So I had a period of probably 3 months where I tore my calf and my hamstring probably 7 or 8 times, and no one really knew what was going on. And it gets quite dark when, you know, something keeps happening, you don't know why it's happening. The people around you don't know why it's happening, and just sort of didn't really see a light at the end of the tunnel at that point. But luckily, we got on top of it. Thought I'd sort of come through that period of, you know, struggle, and got hit with a few more torn muscles into a dislocated shoulder, into a torn ligament in my foot, all sort of this year, which has limited game time to 3 games. I suppose post the dislocated shoulder, it was almost, is my body giving up on me? Is this my body sort of telling me that it's time to hang the boots up and finish there? And I think that's the first time I've ever thought that. And, you know, my wife was looking at me going, is your body giving up? My dad's asking me, is my body giving up? And you get to a point where you're thinking, flipping heck, if they're seeing it, then, you know, am I not seeing something? And yeah. I suppose that was the toughest period for me, was back-to-back-to-back injuries in a short period of time, and really thinking, you know, is this the time to sort of bow out of the game? Mm.
You mentioned there feeling dark times. I mean, interested to hear from your perspective, what that meant. I mean, the impact on day-to-day life and what was going through your head.
Yeah, I suppose I feel I'm a fairly motivated person. I enjoy studying away from the game. I've got a few sort of little things that I do that, you know, I've always had the drive to do, whether that's been after a double day and I'm tired or the day after a game. And I sort of went through that period where I thought, was it worth doing? I'd rather sit on the sofa than do that sort of stuff. If I took the dog for a walk, it was half an hour rather than an hour. And it was, yeah, I suppose I almost became quite lazy and unmotivated, which I feel is very sort of not me. And yeah, that was when I probably started to think, you know, this is probably affecting me a bit more than I thought it had. And I suppose the biggest thing for me was just trying to, Jack spoke about it earlier, was trying to get the structure back. And in my life, we're, as rugby players, we're very lucky that, you know, we get told what to do, when to do it, what to wear, at what time. And to then take that away all of a sudden, it's very easy to be that guy that stays in bed a little bit longer or cuts a few corners.
When we spoke before the podcast, when we had our call, you mentioned the most recent injuries. You were speaking to people and you were also thinking yourself, like, okay, well, this is probably the end. You were thinking, well, what's the point in carrying on? How did that feel in the moment? Like, what's going through your head there?
I suppose the tough one for me at the start was receiving the phone call from the physio and saying, you've dislocated your shoulder. That sort of hit me fairly hard because I felt like I'd worked really hard to get back fit. I'd only lasted 3 games. And I rang my missus and sort of said, look, I've dislocated my shoulder. I'm probably going to have surgery, blah, blah, blah. And I just found myself sort of starting to feel very emotional, started to have that sensation that I was going to cry. And she's never seen me cry. I don't think she's ever heard me cry. And I sort of just had to put the phone down and sort of have a minute to myself. And that's probably the first time that's ever happened to me. That something, I'd say, I don't want to say not significant because dislocating your shoulder is, you know, a fairly big event. But in terms of a rugby player, that's not the end of the world. And as I say, it hit me hard. And yeah, that probably...
Why do you think it hit you hard?
I think, you know, Jackal sort of said the same. As a player, if you're not playing, you feel very undervalued because you're not doing your job. So a lot of your energy is focused towards the rehab, towards getting back early. You've got coaches and players going, you know, how are you getting on? Are you early? Could you be back for this game? And there's that little bit of added pressure that you want to come back early. You want to make sure that you come back in the best shape physically possible. So you do all that. And then, as I say, to last 3 games and do something that's going to keep me out for another 12 weeks, it's that almost, I'm not part of the team. I'm in the gym there in the meetings. You miss that game day buzz and you're sat in the stands or you're doing a Q&A. And those sort of things, I think, as players, impact us a lot because we're not doing the game we love. We're not doing the job we love. And
on that as well, when you touched on how sort of isolated you feel, you could be in the gym with the whole team doing, you could be doing the exact same session, everything could be the same, but you still feel like you're not part of it and you feel like completely isolated. Not that anyone makes you feel that way. I don't know if you feel the same way, Jammer, but for me, like when I was going through my rehab, I just felt like everyone was almost looking at me like, why is he not? Yeah. I don't know. You just the insecurities that go through your head and you become so paranoid and you're like, people don't respect me anymore. People don't think I'm the same guy. Like you're in this with everyone around you, the music blaring, people having fun and laughing. And you're just there thinking, why can I not enjoy the same things they're enjoying?
Because if
I was fit and playing, I'd be laughing at that joke and I'd be getting involved and I'd be chipping in and trying to give a bit of banter. And when you're injured, you just go into your shell and you just think, and I think, you know what, I think this is very, it correlates in a very similar way to when someone is depressed, when they're struggling and that they've got health, like sort of mental health issues at the time, they almost self implode and you isolate yourself from things, which then makes you feel more isolated. And I think it becomes a bit of a vicious cycle.
Definitely.
I definitely felt that in my first set of rehab with my knee and my ankle.
Yeah, it's quite a strange one. You look out on a Tuesday morning and the forwards are mourning and brawling. And at the time, if you're mourning and brawling, you're thinking, what am I doing? Get me inside, get me a coffee in hand and I'll be happy. But then as soon as you're injured and you're watching it happen and you watch the lads come in and they look knackered and they've had a good session and they're almost got a little bit of a buzz about them because they have been mourning and brawling and you're sat there thinking, I wish I could be part of it.
Mm.
And it's just so quick how that mentality changes that you go from being the guy who doesn't want to be out there because it hurts and it's a Tuesday afternoon and it's 24 hours after a game to I'd do anything to be out there.
Mm. Mm. What did you do, James? Obviously, post going through these lows, obviously getting back on the pitch is probably the most important thing. But I mean, talking about your issues, how did you approach that? Was it first speaking to your missus or?
Yeah, I think my missus was the big one, and it was just sort of sitting down over dinner and having a conversation about our days and what I'd achieved in rehab that day. What was my next target for the end of the week? When was our aim at running? Do you know what I mean? It was little things that we spoke about that just allowed me to speak about what I was doing. And like I say, it might have been as stupid as I've caught a tennis ball above my head today, which is so insignificant. But in terms of the shoulder rehab was a big milestone. And I think being able to talk that through and celebrate the little things like that together really helps you to, well, help me to move forward and again, start seeing the light that I am getting that one step closer to playing.
I second that, mate, as well. Like when I had my knee operation and my leg, my quad, my hamstring just melted. Like honestly, it was just the femur and that was it. All this flabby skin around it. After the operation, because of the swelling and the pain around the knee, I physically could not lift my right leg. I just couldn't lift it. And it was day after day after day, the doctor, the little exercise they give you, they say, just try and tense your leg nice and straight and just lift it up lying down. And I just couldn't do it. And they say it's fairly normal, but it was just so frustrating for me. I was like, obviously, at this time, I was sat in the lounge watching England play South Africa on the tour that I was invited to go on, and just thinking, how am I here, not being able to lift up my own leg, and there's these guys having the time of their life. And I think the underpinning feeling was jealousy in some ways, and all. Frustration. There was a few different feelings, but I remember there's actually quite a funny video. I'm sure I could dig it out somewhere. I was trying to lift my leg, and all of a sudden I was just watching it, and my missus is sat next to me, and all of a sudden my legs just started raising off the sofa. I was like, Megan, it's fucking my legs getting. My leg in the air once, absolutely buzzing. And then Megan's got her phone out and filmed me. And I'm like this, lifting my leg up and down a couple of times.
That's great.
Something so small like that can feel like the biggest win. And I think when you're feeling, and this probably correlates to guys that have really struggled with their mental health, that when you're feeling in that position where you're so down and nothing's going your way, the little things that do, celebrate them, as James said, and allow yourself to feel good about it. Because even if it's small and it seems pathetic, and you think, well, why should I be happy about that? Nothing's too small to be happy about at that time. And I think because if you flipped it on its head, you'd find it very easy to see a negative in everything. So why not do it the other way around? Well, I know it's easy to say, but I think trying to strive towards celebrating those little things is always going to end in a positive result.
Jack, let's move on to you, because obviously you had a pretty horrific ACL injury against Saracens in the semi-final. But a week before that, right, you were selected to go on the England tour to South Africa. That was your breakthrough season. So the Talk to me a bit about the run up to obviously being selected for England on that tour, and then what happened with the injury, and then the moments after that.
That season was kind of my breakthrough season into the first team, if you like. It was had my first start that season, and by the end of the season, I managed to get myself in a position to be in the starting lineup for the last few Premiership games, which was a massive achievement. I was chuffed to bits with it, and really happy with where I was at. And then all of a sudden, there was a couple of sort of rumours. Obviously, there's things that get chucked in the papers, like, oh, maybe Willis goes on the England squad and this and that. And you don't read into any of it because you never can. And then I was you sort of end up hoping a little bit. So I knew the announcement was coming out at sort of 9 a.m. or something that day. Kept a bit of an eye out, and all of a sudden I saw my name on the list, and I was like, who else is called Jack Willis in the Premiership? I just didn't believe. And I honestly stood there. Jana will know where I'm on about at Broad Street. There's the portable buildings that we sort of put up, and then the Broad Street changing rooms. I was stood in the middle of the two. And I just burst into tears. And Westy came round the corner and was like, are you all right, Jack? Are you all right? I was like, yeah, no, good news. And I just rang my mum, rang my dad, rang my missus, and we were just chuffed to bits. It was probably one of the best moments of my life. Fast forward 9 days, I was selected to go to play against Saracens in the semi-final. Had a very sore ankle leading up to the game. There was a lot of issues with it, but I was just full of energy and buzzing to be selected for my first semi-final. So there was sort of no stopping me, if you like. Took a few painkillers for the game, gritted through the warm-up, started the game, and it just got worse and worse. My ankle, it was agony. But I think we kind of decided, right, you'll be coming off at half-time. And then all of a sudden, the bounce of the ball sort of come my way, picked the ball up, carried it, and Farrell's, because I didn't really want to put too much weight on my left ankle because of the pain of it, I was relying on my right leg, so I put my right knee down, and Farrell's chop tackled me, and it's basically hyperextended my knee and popped it out and in. The pain that just went through it just basically blew out the whole sort of posterolateral corner. So it was, well, my ACL, but then the LCL, hamstring, popliteus, all that side, and completely torn off the bone. So I'm rolling around squealing, basically my ankle killing me and my knee. And then as I was getting sort of limped off the pitch, I could feel my knee just swaying because there was there wasn't really anything connecting it on the lateral side. And then got back into the changing rooms, and after the game, had sort of my ankles killing me, and I was basically crutching around on my ankle. I was like, look, my ankle's sore as well, but the physios knew how important my knee was and how serious that was, so they were focused on that. Went to the hospital and they did a CT scan to check if there was any sort of nerve damage or any damage to arteries and veins, etc. Mm. And then they came back in. They were like, "Oh, you've got a fracture on your left ankle," and I was like, "Yeah, well, that makes sense." I was like, yeah, sure. And then they were like, okay, well, this is really confusing. So our physio...
The best bit about that is, having done your ACL, you're actually now crutching around on a fractured ankle that you haven't got no idea is fractured.
We sent off for a couple of x-rays. So I went round, had a couple of x-rays, came back, and they were like, yep, you've broken your left ankle. So my tibia, I'd fractured the bottom of my tibia. And then throughout the next couple of weeks, I basically had 2 days later, had my ankle operated on. That was great. Felt like it went really well, really simple. Then 10 days later, had my knee operated on. That was horrific. Like, it, honestly, the pain after the operation was just the worst. Yeah, it was just horrific. It was just nonstop. And that's where I'd say I got to my, the following post knee surgery, the 4, 5, 6 weeks after that were my lowest point, 100%. And I kind of, Jama might have experienced this as well. When you do an injury, there's a weird kind of buzz and excitement around, not excitement, it's a weird way to put it, but there's kind of like this feeling of everyone's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry for you. Oh God, you're going to have an operation. Then you go to this like amazing hospital in London, that's, you get the train down to London. Like for me, I actually, on my another operation I've had, I've stayed, the club had put me up in a hotel the night before. So I was like, oh, I'm in a hotel, I'm having an operation tomorrow. And like, it all feels, because you feel like you can't sort it. And then the next day you wake up from the surgery and you're like, what has happened to me? And then we got home.
It's euphoria of going for to a private hospital for the first time to be realizing I have no right knee. Well, it was your left, was it?
So left ankle, right knee. So
right knee, I have no right knee.
Yeah. I was in a wheelchair for about 6 weeks. And that during that time, whenever I was traveling in a car to go to doctor's appointments or whatever, I had to be lying down. We had to put all the seats down to keep my legs elevated. So I was lying down in the boot with my feet like towards where we were driving and my head just against the boot. Like this, like down.
Ridiculous.
So every journey was just a nightmare, and the swelling in my knee would get worse and worse. And I remember one appointment I went to see the doctor to check up, and I was like, right, I'm going to get some good news today. He's going to be happy with where I'm at and can tell me I can do a bit more of this and that. Got there and he just said, look, it's really swollen. I'm a bit like, it just doesn't look great. I was like, oh God, here we go. And then just waited a couple of days, but anyway, got on the journey home, got home, and I hadn't showered for about 2 weeks after, since the operation for this. And
that's a normal month for Jack Willis then.
went down the road. My grandparents live just down the road and they've got a downstairs bathroom. So we were like, right, that'll be easier. Get the wheelchair in there. So I'm dragging myself around on the floor. Got into the shower, trying to prevent the fact that my grandparents seem a knob. I was jumping in the shower, getting clean, and I was like, right, this feels great. And then got back in the wheelchair, and then my dad sort of pushed me back along to our house, popped me in the back room where I was sleeping on a mattress on the floor because there was nothing, we couldn't go upstairs. And I said, look, Dad, is it all right if you just give me a minute? So he's let me get, sort of just got onto the mattress. And I genuinely reckon I cried for about an hour straight because I just felt helpless. I felt useless. I just felt like a burden to everyone. And I've genuinely never have before or since felt that way. And I think part of it was that I was trying to come off the drugs because OxyContin stuff's not great for you if you're on it for too long. But there was just an element of the fact that I felt useless. And I'd been crying for about 30 minutes. And then my missus got back from work because she'd been, she obviously has to work, finished her day, came home. And then she just sort of laid next to me and just sort of was stroking my head. I felt like a little baby, just crying away, laying straight down, tears coming down like this. And she's just stroking my head, like sort of telling me it'll be all right. And
what were you thinking at the time?
I just felt like when's this going to kind of end? And it was kind of, cause it had been 2 weeks since the operation. And I was like, there's surely it should be starting to feel better. There should be something that's going to make me feel better. And I'm going to pick out of this. And then from that point, it was actually probably a day or so later, I got a text or an Instagram message off, Henry Fraser, who obviously he had a terrible incident where he became paralyzed from the neck down. And he just dropped me a message and said, mate, like fantastic, like you've had a fantastic season. You should be really proud of yourself and you'll smash the injury in the rehab, like all the best for it. And it just hit me so hard that I was like, why am I feeling so sorry for myself when there's a guy here that's in this position for the rest of his life? And it genuinely was a bit of a sort of light bulb inspirational moment just reading that message. And it, for me, it was like, right, this isn't going to go on forever. You're going to find a way out of it. It's going to, in 6 to 8 weeks, you're going to be back weight bearing in some capacity. You're going to start rebuilding. And he's, I'm sure he does have very dark times, but he can, on a day-to-day basis, he'll see the positives out of his day and has achieved so much with everything that he's been hit with. And what I kind of asked myself, why can't I be the same? And as James said earlier, that some of these things feel so massive at the time, when actually it is just a knee injury, it is just an ankle injury, and there's so many things that can happen in your life that are far worse than that. But I'm sure a lot of people end up feeling guilty for the small things that they're struggling with. But you've got to deal with things and deal with the feelings you get on each experience. You can't feel bad for how you're feeling about something that may be small or maybe big. You've just got to accept it and realize that you don't feel guilty for feeling that way. Just try and talk to people about it. And I was just lucky that through that time I had my girlfriend who was fantastic and my family around me.
Mm. You talk about the burden. You've got quite an a funny story about guacamole.
So this was probably a couple of weeks on from the whole crying on the mattress situation. So during this time, my missus was an absolute hero. We basically, so I did my injury. I had my knee operation on the 30th of May. And on the 29th of May, we moved into our house, the house that we bought together. So I was in a wheelchair and my missus has basically moved us into the house. And I'm just sat there like, put that there, So she's been absolutely hero. We had to live with on the mattress downstairs because I couldn't get upstairs. So she's working flat out throughout the days, trying to cook for me, make sure all my drugs are. She's got a little diary of the timings. I need everything, and she was just flat out trying to also organise the house, empty boxes. So she was knackered. It was about sort of half 11 one day, and she's fast asleep on the mattress, and I'm lying there as well because I've been lying on my ass for the last month. I was like, you know what? I was like, I'm going to make lunch today. So I got up and I've got myself into the wheelchair. Bear in mind, both my legs are out straight. I can't have them down. So I'm like nudging things everywhere I go. Popped some turkey burgers in the oven, and I was like, right, what would be nice of this? Some guacamole. So I've got... trying to get, and bear in mind it's so slow trying to get all this out of the cupboards and stuff, but I managed to get there. Megan's not made too much noise, she's still asleep. So I cut the avocados out and I started like mashing them, and they weren't ripe. And I was like, they're not fucking ripe. And I'm trying to squish them down, and then I've like managed to get like a blender kind of thing out, put them in the blender. I was like, that'll work. So it's blitzed it up, but it almost had like a grainy texture. It was horrible. Yeah,
that'll work, and it definitely won't wake her up either.
I've just sat there and I just started crying over the fact I couldn't even make guacamole for it. And I'm sweating, I had to take my t-shirt off because everything's just so much of an effort, and I'm sat there crying over a bowl of guacamole, and she's like, what am I doing? And I think it's just silly things like that you just think, you look back on it and think, why did I get so upset about it? And I think that's probably the only thing I'd say to people is, when you, no matter how long it takes or no matter how long you feel like you're in that hole, when you do get out of it and look back on it, you realize that it was just a period of time that you couldn't really deal with those situations the way that you would normally deal with it. And then some of those situations are actually funny. There was one that you told me about, James, that was, you might want to tell me that. This is above James, as in not Jammer. About car in the river?
My car in the river, yeah. Now, what story that is. But, there's two, actually. One with my... because I did a very similar injury to you, Jack, obviously playing in the 10th division of English rugby. But yeah, like 3 weeks after my injury, I was kept falling over in the shower because I was on crutches, and my dad having to walk in, and I'm in tears in the shower, completely bollock naked, and I'm crawling out the shower, like, and he's like, fuck me, what is this? I was giving him my crutch, like, please help. But yeah, it happens. And my car, oh my God. Bearing in mind, obviously, it'd been a tough 5 months at that stage where I'd gone through everything I'd gone through, and this was March, late Feb, start of March, late Feb, and sat down with my girlfriend because we were discussing in this coffee shop, like, okay, well, you're at your lowest now. She was like, there's nothing else that could go wrong. It's 3 o'clock, and so. So we were like mapping out what makes me happy and trying to get all of this stuff in order so my mind could just be at rest. And then I was like, okay, well, I'll drop you to your meeting and then I'll go home. So I went back to my car, and she had parked my car. We live in Putney, but she'd parked my car down by the river, amazingly, on the river slip road down by the rowing clubs on these yellow lines. And this was the day after Storm Kira had finished. So they've opened the Thames Barrier and they haven't told anybody. So at half four, I've walked down to get my car, and I'm literally walking down this hill and there is water coming up to my ankles. And I walk a bit further down, and I'm like, where the hell is my car? There's water up to my knees. And then there's a load of rowers on a balcony going, have you seen that BMW floating down the river? And I'm like, oh my, literally my car is bobbing down the river. It's got its windscreen wipers off on. And there was about 30 cars that were damaged on that day. And mine was the only one to be swept off, and swept away down the river. And literally there's a video that I showed you, Jack, which was, you've literally got rowers rowing next to my car past it as it's bobbing down. And I was like, right, I need to leave this country now. So, that was the indicator that we needed to go to Bali for 3 weeks so I could find myself. So,
wow.
I know. James, I want to touch on the Kiernan and Miles situation just briefly. Obviously, Kiernan has had his struggles pretty well documented. Did that article in the Daily Mail, and has an amazing story, and I'm hoping one day I can speak to him about it. But you were in and around Kiernan at the time that he was going through this sort of stuff, but you didn't really have any idea that it was going on. So, like, what are your reflections on what happened with Kiernan? Not to go into too much detail, because obviously it's a difficult episode to talk about.
Yeah, so me and Kiernan have known each other for sort of 10 plus years now. We've lived together, we've played at two different clubs together, and I suppose we're fairly similar in a lot of ways. And at the time, sort of a lot of it was happening was he wasn't getting picked in the team, and you know, Kiernan's always been a first choice player wherever he's been. And I think as Jackal's probably backed me up, that if you're not getting picked, it's hard. You don't know sort of where you are. You're in the non-23, then you've got to maybe travel with the team, and you become quite a grumpy person. And you know, I think a lot of our misses can vouch for that as well. And it's we are quite tough to live with. And you know, for me, I just thought Kiernan was going through another one of those sort of periods. He hadn't played for a few weeks, and I guess probably didn't look too seriously into it. And as I say, everything happened, and somehow he sort of kept it between himself and Charlie for a couple of years until he's come out and told his story. And you sort of read through the article, and I was like, hang on, I was on that trip and I was there, and you start thinking, how have I missed all this? And you know, we'd see each other every day at training, you know, we'd speak on the phone. He lived around the corner from myself and Robbie Miller in London, so you know, he was around for dinner a fair bit or just to watch some TV. And you know, you see that he's struggling, and you just think it's rugby related, and you don't really think that it's anything else. And again, it probably comes down to that macho portrayal of a rugby player. You just think, well, he'll get on with it. So yeah, looking back, I remember at the time me and Rob trying to have some conversations with him, and it was the whole, yeah, I'm fine, and probably should have treated him like my missus then rather than one of the lads and asked a few more questions. So yeah, for me it was very hard to read the article, and it was very hard to chat to him afterwards and think.
Can you remember seeing a sorry to interrupt, but can you remember seeing a difference in Kiernan? Because obviously you'd ask, how are you doing? But can you kind of remember whether there'd be a noticeable change?
Yeah, he sort of became fairly withdrawn. At Broad Street, we're all in sort of three or four different changing rooms, and we're obviously in the same changing room. And instead of having a coffee with the lads in the team room, you'd find him in the changing room reading an article. And if you know Kiernan, you wouldn't think that's overly strange, but then, because he likes to spend time sort of on his own, he likes to do his reading and stuff. But when you actually look back, you think he's actually a very social person as well. He likes to come for a coffee, he likes a conversation, he likes a bit of banter. So again, it probably interpreted the situation wrong, but again, you start to ask yourself a lot of questions. Could I have seen this? Was that a sign that I've not picked up on him? Yeah, I think a lot of it, if I had the chance again, would be just to ask more questions and ask more than, are you okay? Because, and fine really isn't the right answer.
No. Fine is a huge indicator.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it, as I say, awareness of the situations and the whole speaking has become a lot more sort of prevalent in the last couple of years. And again, if the situation had been now, I'm sure I would have acted a lot differently. And I think that's just through a lot of education and speaking to a lot more people and seeing a lot more people go through with it.
Well, James, I think what you said there is bang on. Like a couple of years ago, I could probably look back at myself where I've had conversations with people and they've been, oh yeah, I'm not great today or whatever. And I'd be like, oh, come on, mate. Like, you'll be all right. Like, you just... It was, I wasn't educated enough on it. And I didn't know enough about it.
It's instinctive, right?
Yeah. You just think, oh, come on, mate, you'll be all right. Like, God, what about this? Like, you're playing rugby. Like, it must be buzzing. Like,
yeah.
What is that? And you just say it. I read the other day something about a player, I think he was up in Scotland, that he spoke to a coach or something, and he was feeling down. And the coach's like, you're all right. And he's like, no, I feel rubbish at the moment. I'm really down. He's like, oh, fucking hell, mate, you're a rugby player. What have you got to feel shit about?
Yeah.
And that coach, he's probably a top bloke. And at that time, he probably just didn't know about this stuff. And none of us did, really. There wasn't really an education on it. Whereas this season and the season before, the amount of education and the amount that people are talking about it, you realise that there are people that are going through stuff a lot more than you realise. But I still think there's a lot of education that needs to be done on the cues and how to pick up stuff, because some people answer questions like, no, I'm really good at the moment. And like, they would say that, but deep down inside, they could be in their darkest time, but it's because they know they don't want to open up. So it's about what's the best way to sort of start a dialogue with someone and open it up, even if you're good mates. Like, that may not be part of your relationship that you talk about. Especially in a rugby environment, really the done thing.
Sounds like it's not quite the verbal signals; it's also the physical and the behavioural signals that needs to be addressed too.
Yeah,
for sure. I think it's like you say; it's a lot easier for somebody to go, yeah, I'm fine, and they can put a smile on their face and crack on. But when you actually look at it and you think, well, you might not have come for a drink after work on a Friday for the last 4 weeks. Mm. When he'd be there every week, or as I say, going and sitting in the changing room on your own rather than socialising with the lads over a coffee. Like, at the time, you don't see them as seeing sort of big triggers, I guess, but when you look back, they are fairly substantial signs that you should probably pick up on. But again, I think that, like Jack said, a lot of that comes down to the education and just being aware of your surroundings and the situations that you're in.
Obviously the RPA do a huge amount of work in rugby and also obviously Restart Rugby in helping players with mental health, etc. But what do you think rugby can in general do better? Because obviously it is one of those sports where people don't really tend to talk about their issues, and it's really only the last few years that it's becoming more and more prevalent. And obviously, James, you've been in the game a little bit longer than Jack has. Interested to see how, from your perspective, how things have progressed in your 12 years being in the game, but also what can rugby do better in general?
Yeah, it's definitely chalk and cheese.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. I think from when I started to now, a lot of it was, I guess, a lot of the mentality was just basically toughen up, man up, I guess is probably the easiest thing that people were saying. If sort of something hurt, it was get on with it. If you were struggling with an injury while you're young, get on with it. Like, it was that sort of mentality. There was never, are you actually okay? And I think where you look at rugby now, and I don't know whether it's just WASP because we are a very close bunch of lads, but I imagine it is probably across the board that we socialise a lot together. We speak a lot. The WhatsApp groups are constantly going off. I say it's not just three or four people you're close to, it's 10, 11, 12, if not more, that you know, you have regular dialogue with away from the club. And I think the more that is present within clubs, the better it's going to be for picking up on the signs of whether people are struggling or not. Mm. And as I say, I think the RPA do a fantastic job. And I think, you know, there's never going to be a perfect situation. I think people are always going to slip through the net, unfortunately. But I think they do the best they can, and they offer the services as best as they can with the best of their abilities to allow the people that need to speak to speak. I don't know what you think, Jack, but you know, there's always more people can do. But I think for what they're doing a very good job at the minute.
I completely agree. I think the RPA do a fantastic job. I think the trouble is with what we do, there's some things that will never change, and that's the pressure, the competitive nature of the sport, and some of the combinations of selection, like selection when people are selected, injuries. There's things that are going to trigger things that will test your mental health, I think, and that's always going to be there in the sport. Yeah. And I don't think you can change that if you're a professional sportsman, or even if you play sport at your local club, just for a bit of fun, as you were joking about earlier in level 10 or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's there's still going to be times where if you're not picked or you got told to play for the seconds or the A-League or whatever, you're going to be a bit like, oh, well, I really wanted to play this week. And then that could trigger something. And if that happens for 6 weeks in a row, it's always going to be there. I think...
One sec, gents. I just need to go answer the doorbell because somebody, I think an iPhone's been dropped. Going to have to edit this part out, obviously.
We run in tomorrow, kid.
Yes, you're keen for it.
Are we going to go early doors?
Yeah, go early. Get it done.
Should we go 8:30?
Happy days, yeah.
I did anything today?
Hit workout with Megan this morning.
Oh, dirty.
You've been doing these like Instagram live hit workouts.
Yeah.
And they would look well tough. And I was like, right, okay. It was basically like a boxing one today. So I got 4.5 kg dumbbells. I was like, that'd be sweet. And you're boxing for a minute straight, so your shoulders, mate, on fire. I was like, so you're doing this and jabs and hooks, and then you're doing like, it was literally just burpees for a minute. And they were like proper like, so it was actually mental. I was like, I thought it was going to be a piece of piss. And then you do that and you're like, I got at the end of it. I was like, perfect.
Yeah, she couldn't run a Bronco, though, kid.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I'm back. That actually wasn't the Amazon parcel. Because it was my girlfriend's mum asking it, with a dog asking what I was doing. Great. <That's>
fantastic.
Anyway, sorry, Jack, what were you saying? Probably can't even remember now.
No. Yeah, talk about the idea, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I think some people, when they're struggling as well, there's only so much the RPA can provide and the sort of counselling services and stuff. But I think sometimes for me, I know for a fact that when I was in that sort of period where I was struggling around the operations, I didn't really want to talk to anyone in a professional capacity. I was more focused on just leaning on my family and friends, and Megan, my girlfriend. But then I know there's people that, on the flip side, don't want to do that. They'd rather talk to someone completely independent. I think when, so obviously with my ankle and knee and stuff, I got back, played three games, and then the ankle happened again. I had a lot more of a carefree kind of attitude. And I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing, but I was a bit like, well, if this happens again, it happens again. I kind of can't be bothered with it anymore. And you kind of become a bit numb to it all. And in the end managed to get back and the ankle feels all right. But during that sort of second course of rehab, there was one thing that I made sure I didn't do. You know, when we spoke earlier about feeling isolated within a gym and coffees and stuff like that, I made sure that I didn't just sit at home and say no to a coffee. I was like, even if I really didn't want to go, I could be like, I could see a message on the group and be like, I do not want to go at all. I would get up, go to the coffee shop and say, right, spend 10 minutes, have your coffee, and then you can leave. But I would always spend probably 2 hours there chatting away and get back home and be like, I'm so happy I did that. So even when you think that is not going to help me at all, being around your mates and being around your family, being around your friends, and it helps. It does help. And just chatting away, chatting about absolute shit sometimes. Yeah. Something that's completely different to what's going on in your head, just to distract you away from it. And I think, like, the amount of coffees me and Jammer have had where we've sapping away about something or chatting, trying to save the world in some capacity and just talking twaddle, it's nice. It just distracts you from it.
Yeah, for sure. Couldn't agree more with you there, kid. Couldn't agree more.
Life outside of rugby is obviously a relatively daunting prospect for a lot of players. You've said a few times how you get told what to eat, when to eat. Obviously, probably when to poo in Reader's case. but how are you guys dealing with that prospect? Obviously, Jack, you've got your own. I wouldn't call it property empire just yet, but property.
So basically, I've sort of partnered up with Alex Lundberg, who used to be at WAS. He's unfortunately had to retire from rugby, so he's in that situation of life in after rugby right now. And I think it sort of proves how quickly that can be taken away, and how proves how that it really is a sport that you can't take for granted. So him and I, we've recently set up a sort of search agency, if you like, and we sort of introduce opportunities to investors, developers and funds, and work with them on trying to find them sites that suit them and opportunities. So that's quite exciting. Hopefully, as you said then, it will turn into a property empire, but it's definitely not quite there yet.
Mate, it's great. It's great to hear that you're thinking outside rugby, because obviously you hear a lot of players who are so fixated on rugby, and often for good reasons too, but it becomes everything, and that is where you find that there's a lot of problems outside of rugby which start. James, like, what does life outside of rugby look like for you, and how do you deal with that? Also life after rugby as well.
Yeah, I guess I've always been sort of fairly aware that rugby isn't a means to an end. There is a job after rugby, there is life after rugby, and I suppose with the nature of the sport is that, you know, you could play a game on a Saturday and that could be the last game you ever play, and you could be 20 or you could be 35 when that happens. So it's, again, that's a fairly dark way to think of it. But as I say, there is a life after rugby and you always need bread on the table. So I guess education has always been a big one for me. I've sort of always tried to study away from the sport. And it even got to a point, I went back and did my A-level biology. I failed it at school and thought I'd test myself and see whether I could do it. And I wouldn't say C was particularly impressive, but, you know, I was happy enough just to sort of do something and prove that I could do it. And I guess it's taken me a while to sort of work out what I wanted to do. So I'm currently completing a strength and conditioning degree with, I don't know whether coaching or strength and conditioning coaching is where I want to end up. But, you know, I think, as you said, I've always had a structure and rugby's always been that structure. And I think if I can somehow stay in the sport, whether that's academy coach, academy S&C, a forwards coach or what, you know, I don't really know yet, but it'd be nice to sort of give back to the game something that, you know, it's given me over the last 12 years.
Mm. How big of a line-out noise are you?
I love a line-out. I'll happily sit down on a Sunday and watch a few hours of lineouts. It gives me a real sort. Brings a smile to my face, mate.
Yeah, I mean, Steve Borthwick has obviously been the flag bearer for lineout nausing and has done pretty well with England. So
that's, yeah, it's a fairly niche job. I don't think many second rows out there are happy to watch that many lineouts over and over again. And when you've got options like Jack down there, who can't keep his legs together, then you got to be fairly smart about what you do.
I'll teach you how to hit some rocks and then you can teach me.
There we go.
Gents, look, appreciate your time on this, and thanks so much for talking pretty openly about your
your battles with various different degrees and of mental health is super important. One of the things that we spoke about, James, on the phone, you were like, I'm not really sure how important or how severe my mental health has been, so I'm not sure whether this is like what you're looking for. And I was like, do you know what, it's exactly what we need, somebody talking about something that they don't actually think is that relevant, or well, not relevant, but that important nor severe, important is right, severe, and actually it's entirely unique to everybody, and it does not discriminate whether you are somebody who is an alcoholic because their life has fallen apart because they've had somebody who's died, or you're a professional rugby player who's not being selected. It's unique and it's important. So I just want to say thank you both for taking the time.
Nice. Thank you very much for having us on, mate.
Yeah, thank you for having us on, mate. It was good to sort of talk about it, and hopefully it, even if it helps a couple of people, then we've done our bit.
Awesome. Look, cheers, boys.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you, thanks, mate.
Hey guys, thanks for listening and supporting the podcast. Please subscribe if you haven't already, and find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter and LinkedIn through @TheRuckPod for more updates on who's coming up next on the show. Special thanks to my team Ricky Batchew and Phil Bateman for helping me produce The Ruck. Next time on The Ruck, I sit down with entrepreneur James Ski, who talks about his battles with bipolar disorder. See you then.